From the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of November 19th, 2010. We are in the city of brotherly love this week to address a topic we all love to hate and hate to love, healthcare. The passage this year of a massive health reform bill generated some love, some hate, and a lot of confusion. All the reforms won't kick in until 2014, but changes are already underway and will affect your wallets and bank accounts. You're probably seeing them right now because of open enrollment season. So we'll address a few of them this hour and on our website with our Consumer's Guide to Healthcare. Now, why Philly? Well, a whole lot of medical history has been made here. The first hospital, the first medical school. They invented Tylenol here.
Ben Franklin!
Marketplace's healthcare reporter Gregory Warner joining us. Your newest obsession here. Are we going to hear from you later in the show?
We are, Tess, but I wanted to stop by because I have this great surprise for you about Ben Franklin.
Oh, I like surprises.
Okay, so picture Ben Franklin. How does he look?
He's got the white hair, the spectacles, a portly gentleman.
A little bit tubby, right?
Tubby, sure.
Okay. So I was talking to Roy Goodman, the head librarian over at the Philosophical Society. It's got the largest collection of Franklin archives in the world. Here's how he described him.
Well, he had muscles. He was no flabby dude.
I think that's the first time I've heard Franklin referred to as a dude. Then why do we think of him as so big?
Well, he got older, he got fat. But for most of his life, Franklin was eating lean. He ate local foods, lots of veggies, worked out with dumbbells.
Let me interrupt your reverie here. Can we get to the money part of all this?
Sure. Okay, so it starts with Franklin being a printer, right?
Right.
And let's just cue some sound effects here.
I like sound effects.
Okay, so I recorded this a few blocks away, actually, at the Franklin Print Shop. You hear that old press going?
Yeah.
Now imagine, 1700s, what's coming out of those Franklin presses? A lot of popular health literature.
Huh.
Titles like Every Man His Own Doctor, or The Art of Preserving Health, and then the almanacs full of health tips and herbal remedies.
Right.
Here's Goodman again.
The Franklin Poor Richard Almanac circulated in editions of 10,000 a year. That's an incredible amount. So some people have called his network sort of the internet of the 18th century.
So this would have been then the Web MD?
You know, in a way, yeah, because where would you get healthcare information? This was something for everyone. Obviously, every man his own doctor.
Healthcare for all.
Healthcare for all.
But actually, Gregory, I mean, are we really talking healthcare information for all, right?
Right. And that gets us to the money.
Ah, finally. Go on.
Well, that story starts with Franklin's friend, John Bartram. He was this Philadelphia farmer who loved plants. He used to travel all around the colonies digging up new medicinal herbs that he could bring back to Philadelphia. But Bartram wasn't just collecting plants to look at them. He wanted to create a market.
Huh.
And it would go like this. Bartram would find it, Franklin would publish something about it, and then readers would go seek it out.
In a sense, when Franklin's advertising this medicine, isn't he starting up a new industry? You know, a new industry in plants.
Let me guess, that would be the pharmaceutical industry?
Or as Franklin would have called it, economic botany.
Economic botany, all right.
And it all starts with keeping that patient informed, because if people don't know what's out there for their health, they don't know what to buy.
Yeah, so you have an informed patient, then you have a potential customer.
Exactly.
All right, well, Gregory, I think we really are going to say goodbye to you for now, but you're going to be back a bit later with another chapter of, what are we calling this series?
Philadelphia's lesser-known historical contributions to the business of healthcare.
That would be the short title?
That's what I got.
All right, thanks.
Thanks.
So as Ben Franklin knew, when it comes to health, the more we know, the more we tend to buy. Or at least the more someone tries to sell us. And that's true today. So we thought we'd hear about the experience of navigating the system from the ultimate informed patient. Here's WHYY's Carrie Grenz.
I've been a health reporter for 6 years, but I've never walked into a hospital without a microphone. And in fact, I'd never really been a patient until I started coming in with something doctors and insurance companies code as V22.0, also known as pregnancy. Now, as I sit here out of breath from my peanut-sized lungs and my watermelon-sized belly, I'm a regular.
So where is this kid kicking you mostly?
I feel the hiccups slow down, mm-hmm. And then I feel the baby usually over on this side more.
I've had 12 checkups, had my blood drawn, made 2 trips to the hospital for screening tests, and I've peed in a cup a lot. Although I've interviewed people about their struggles with copays and getting procedures denied, my insurance paid everything but $20.
From the insurance company's perspective, they want to encourage you to get the prenatal visits because the payoff to them is huge, the difference between having a healthy baby and an unhealthy baby.
That's Rob Field. He's a healthcare regulation expert at Drexel Law School. Obviously, preventing problems is cheaper than treating them after the fact, but insurers have another incentive to treat me well.
Insurance companies love having healthy young women about to give birth. It's their perfect demographic. They then get a healthy young family who are likely to not run up the bill.
After all the stories I've written about the downsides of screening tests, the false alarms, the unnecessary interventions, I didn't even want one ultrasound.
If you detect it early, for example, heart defect or other defects, it has been shown that the preparations you're going to make before delivery are going to improve that outcome.
Leave it to Vincenzo Bergella, the head of fetal and maternal medicine at Thomas Jefferson University, to knock me back into what-if mode. Even though very few babies have a defect, could I live with myself if I chose to skip this scan just to avoid a false alarm? So I got it.
Cigarette smoking, probably not a good idea. Caffeine, sugar substitutes.
My husband Bob and I have been reading through a stack of popular pregnancy books full of warnings.
Sports, hot tubs, microwave exposure.
The problem with these warnings is that they don't put anything into context. How long do I have to stand in front of a microwave for it to hurt my baby? I've been operating under the assumption that pregnancy is a healthy condition. And so I decided from the beginning that I didn't need to see a doctor.
Midwives, we're trained in the normal, natural process, versus obstetricians are trained surgeons.
Nicole Black is a certified nurse midwife at a birth center in Wilmington, Delaware.
And so I think sometimes, you know, you sort of rise the level of what your training is. And so it's like, you know, okay, well, there's something going on here. Well, it might just be easier to do a cesarean. Versus midwives, we don't necessarily have those skills. There's not something in our skill set. And so we don't necessarily go to that right away.
Black's not my midwife, but she was my inspiration. I had interviewed her last year about out-of-hospital births and liked the idea. But it's just like with the ultrasound. Even though it's highly unlikely that something would go wrong, I couldn't let go of the security of an operating room and an intensive care unit down the hall. And so I found a compromise. The midwives I see deliver babies at a hospital. For now, I can entertain myself by thinking about baby names and breastfeeding and not about being sick. And that's what makes pregnancy different from everything we lump under healthcare and pay for with insurance. As Rob Field at Drexel points out, it's not a disease.
I think pregnancy does stand out in that regard as being something very positive that you get someone else to pay for. How often does that happen in life?
For this reporter, at least once. I'm Carrie Grenz for Marketplace Money.
And Carrie's 6-pound, 11-ounce baby, Henry Paul, has since arrived. There's a photo at marketplace.org. We mentioned earlier that Philadelphia is home to the nation's first hospital, Pennsylvania Hospital, founded in 1751 by Ben Franklin. On the top floor of the Grand Colonial Building is a surgical amphitheater. It's where med students and locals paid to watch doctors perform surgeries without anesthesia. We decided it was a good place to meet Mark Pauley. He's a health economist with the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. I wanted to ask him a question I've long had about healthcare, which is, if we all complain that we pay too much for it, then how much should we pay? Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I want to start with a personal anecdote, if I may. I was diagnosed with melanoma 7 years ago and had to have surgery for that. I'm one of those strange people who kept my explanation of benefits, and I added up the total, and the cost for my cancer was just shy of $30,000. I paid $25 in copays. Is that appropriate? Should I have paid more?
to judge from what Americans prefer, the answer is no. We don't want to have to worry about paying, and we want no stone left unturned in our treatment. And then we are outraged when we discover how expensive health insurance premiums are. And here's a case where imagining that there's some way you can have it all and not pay for it is just not going to happen any more than it happens anywhere else.
Who pays the rest of the cost of my cancer treatment? And what goes into determining who pays?
Well, if you were privately insured, you probably paid the cost of your treatment and then some, because hospitals provide care to a lot of people who don't pay the cost. So the rest of us pay that have private insurance a bit more to offset that. The other thing that economists are programmed to mention is that, in a way, the taxpayers are paying for our health insurance. When we get compensation in the form of health insurance, we don't have to pay any income tax on it, any payroll tax. So we're subsidizing each other's health insurance.
We don't seem to really question when we're told that we're going to pay a lot of money to drive a car or to own a house. But there is a large hue and cry about what we pay for health care. Now, given we are paying more for health care than we are for those other things, but when you're talking life and death, how much should that burden fall on the patient?
Well, of course, sooner or later, we all end up paying for our insurance. The idea that our employer pays it is a bit of a fiction, because that comes out of what otherwise would have been our wages.
Right.
Probably doesn't come out of the employer's profit. The main place, I think, where people do make a choice is not in the surgery room like we are here, but when they're sitting in their living room looking over their benefits options for the upcoming year.
I want to talk a little bit about the variability in what you pay versus what I pay versus what other people would pay. Most people know the factors that go into determining the cost of car insurance. It's how many tickets you have, it's your age, it's how many accidents you've had. Healthcare doesn't work remotely that way. Why?
I think it's because healthcare has high fixed costs, which means that there's always room to negotiate a discount. Some insurers are better, for various reasons, at negotiating discounts compared to others. But no matter what kind of deal you get, it's going to be expensive.
So what will the impact be of health care reform on the consumer pocketbook?
Obviously, if you're a low-income, uninsured person, it's a good impact. You are going to have what is not only a major threat to your life, but also a major threat to your financial well-being protected. And for the rest of us, I think we're back to, unfortunately, my grim story. Nobody wants to sit next to health economists at a dinner party, because all we have to say is, well, if you want to save money, we can save you money. You'll just have to tell me what you want to give up.
All right, yes. I think I will pass on that dinner party with you.
Okay, thank you.
Mark Pauly is a health economist at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, and we've been talking in the surgical amphitheater of Pennsylvania Hospital. Thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you.
And there's a lot more coming up. Visit our website for tips on how to save money by staying healthy. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and we are in Philadelphia for a special hour on healthcare. Pennsylvania Hospital used to sell tickets for the public to watch those surgeries in the amphitheater we visited. Those ticket sales paid the surgery costs for poor patients. Ticket for ticket, the biggest crowd pleaser was the so-called father of surgery, Philip Fizik. Marketplace's Gregory Warner is back with another edition of Philadelphia's lesser-known historical contributions to the business of healthcare.
So, Del, maybe we could just start if you give me a list of all the firsts associated with Dr. Fizik.
I will give it an attempt. I'm not sure I can get all of them, but he does the first cataract operations in America, the first stomach pump in America. First,
this is J. Del Connor, the great-great-great-grandson of Dr. Philip Singh Fizik.
He does the first human blood transfusion in the world.
Connor used to get beat up in elementary school for talking too much about his ancestor.
I was thought to be a bit of a boaster.
Now he gives tours of Dr. Fizik's house here in Philadelphia. He shows me the dozens of instruments that Dr. Fizik invented.
Instruments still used today for removing cataracts, gallstones. He would have done double mastectomies on women who had breast cancer. In one operation on his aunt, it talks about her being led into the room blindfolded so she would not see those instruments laid out on the table that would be used on her momentarily without anesthesia or antiseptics. So it's just incredible.
But Dr. Fizik might never have become the innovator in medicine we know today if he had not invented something else first, a business model. Flashback to the 1780s. Young Fizik sails to London to study with the brightest surgeons in England. He rises in his class despite being from a place they thought should still be a colony. In 1792, he returns to Philadelphia, medical degree in hand. He's 24 years old, America is in a recession, and to make things worse, his father cuts him off, saying, "He paid for med school, now get a job."
He would walk the streets looking for work, so much so that his shoes were worn out.
Making a living as a surgeon wasn't so simple. This wasn't Europe, where medical doctors enjoyed the esteem of their profession. When Dr. Fizik looks around Philadelphia, what he saw were traveling herbalists, bone setters, and sellers of elixirs. If someone needed surgery, the first place they'd probably go was a barber.
A barber would do a lot of bloodletting and minor surgeries.
Fizik had to find a way to elevate his services above the remedies of these other peddlers, and so he decided to offer his patients a deal. Pay him just $20 up front, he'd treat your whole family for a year.
He is the first to offer this package deal of payment in advance for future services.
It's a new way of paying doctors.
Yes, an early form of health insurance.
And apparently, the first HMO. In this way, Dr. Fizik not only locked in his customer base, he ensured that when his patients needed medical advice, they came to him first.
And so he was able to get a little bit of cash flow going and a new pair of shoes, as legend has it.
As his cash flow grows, so does his catalog of inventions. He becomes the father of surgery and the richest doctor in Philadelphia.
You can see a reenactment of one of Dr. Fizik's surgeries in that amphitheater. It's at marketplace.org. Obviously, a lot has changed since those days. In fact, health insurance is morphing as we speak. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, those changes are showing up in open enrollment season. Unhealthy workers cost companies more money, so bosses are looking for ways to get employees to give up their bad habits, sometimes by carrot, sometimes by stick, WHYY's Tanya English reports.
At Campbell, the company's cooked up a friendly competition. It pits factory workers in Texas against tomato processors in California and the folks at headquarters in Camden, New Jersey. The contest is over which site can get the most workers to take an online health risk assessment. If enough people fill out the survey about their health habits and lifestyle, everyone in the group gets a $50 gift card. Some lucky winners will get a year of free health insurance. And then there's bragging rights.
So not only will they get a trophy, which is actually a very coveted award, it's kind of like the Stanley Cup of annual enrollment. We pass it from plant to plant each year.
That's Jan Kelly. Her team creates incentive programs. At Campbell, the nudging never stops. There are prizes for working out, and stickers point to the healthiest choices in the vending machine.
Thank you.
At the company cafeteria, apples and oranges are stacked up beside the cash register. If you skip the french fries in favor of a small salad, you'll save a dollar.
Right now, I'm going to measure your waist, okay? What I need you to do is hold this right here in the middle for me. I'm going to go around you, okay?
I caught up with John Faulkner at one of Campbell's morning health fairs. The 52-year-old was getting his middle measured and his cholesterol checked. Last year, he was told his body fat was too high. He dropped more than 30 pounds.
Candidly, my wife sort of hit me over the side of the head and said, okay, you know, you've got to go after this. And it was a real team effort, so... You know, she makes egg beaters in the morning for me and was sending me with a salad for lunch.
At Campbell's sleek new fitness center, Amanda Hershon hits the treadmill right after work. Hershon, a communications specialist, started exercising and eating better 2 years ago.
I was just at a size 12. I just was trying to make the decision as to whether or not I was going to leave my pants open when I was sitting down, rebutton the fly. I mean, it was really bad. I didn't want to keep buying new clothes.
Now Hershon's a bit of a fitness celebrity. She was written up in the company newsletter and won $500 in cash. Campbell's health strategy isn't all carrots. There are also sticks. Again, benefits administrator Jan Kelly.
If you are a tobacco user, there is a $20 per month surcharge that you'll pay for participating in the medical plan.
But the fee is waived if you complete a Smokeenders class. Not all of the payoffs require sweating or counting calories. Employees considering an elective operation, like a knee replacement or weight loss surgery, can earn a $200 gift card simply by discussing their treatment options with a nurse or counselor. The program is voluntary, and it's run by an independent medical information company. Kelly says about 25% of people decide not to have the operation or opt for less invasive, less costly treatment after discussing their alternatives. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan says workers do need better information about which doctors and hospitals have the best track record. Still, he's wary.
The last person I want to trust for my advice about those things is the person who's going to pay most of the bill. So there is an inherent conflict of interest if the sole source of information coming in workplace-based programs are the people who are trying to tamp the cost down.
Kaplan leads the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He says he also worries about how those health assessments get used. Kelly says Campbell is strict about keeping worker information private. With all Campbell's nudging, are any of the incentives working? The experts aren't sure, and Amanda Hirshon says, for her, the promise of a gift card didn't make much of an impression.
You know, maybe there was a raffle. I'm not really sure. If there was one, that's not what motivated me in the least bit.
It may be that keeping your wife off your case or wanting to fit into your favorite jeans works about as well as anything that your company is doing. I'm Tanya English for Marketplace Money.
Shifting more responsibility for healthcare onto the individual sounds a lot like what's happened with retirement over the last decade. We went from a pension system where decisions were made by employers to 401ks where we are responsible for our own investments, with mixed results. Jacob Hacker is an expert on the politics of health and social policy at Yale. His book, The Great Risk Shift, explores the ramifications of making individuals more responsible for those financial decisions. I asked him how it's working in healthcare.
We are paying a lot more of the cost of care out of pocket than we used to. And just over the last 10 years, we've seen premiums for employer-provided health insurance more than double. And the share that workers are paying of that premium has risen by about 150%, so it's even risen more. Meanwhile, if you're buying coverage individually, those costs have been skyrocketing. So, yeah, we've got a lot more skin in the game in healthcare, but we're still a long way from having that kind of individual responsibility model that we have in 401k retirement pensions.
And yet you do hear people say that, for example, we need to be an informed patient and perhaps look around for where we're going to get the best deal on our health care. And so some of that responsibility is now shifting as well, isn't it?
It is. And there is some research on this question. And what it shows is that people do spend less when they have to pay more of the cost out of pocket, but they're actually not very good at distinguishing between necessary and unnecessary care. So they basically spend less on everything.
The patient generally does not have an MD to make that decision.
Yeah, and I mean, we do have more information through the web, but we should be clear, most of the costs in healthcare are for the really high cost cases where people are in emergency rooms or they're in intensive care units. They're not really in the position where they're going to be able to make these kind of informed decisions about how to spend their money. So we should understand that although putting more of the costs onto people will probably deter people from seeking care, especially people who have less money. But we shouldn't be under the illusion that people will suddenly, you know, be able to make the kind of decisions that are often very difficult for doctors and other providers.
Then how is this whole debate going to shake out? We ended up getting a retirement system that is by and large placed on our own shoulders as individuals. Is it possible to compare that to healthcare? I mean, retirement is not life and death. But if you are having to make your own cost decisions for healthcare, isn't it possible that you're going to make the wrong ones because you don't or can't pay what's expected?
Absolutely. And that's the grand debate that we really didn't have with retirement. I mean, I would say that we think about healthcare a little differently than we think about retirement. Retirement is something that we're planning for decades, or we should be, whereas healthcare is a much more immediate concern. And, you know, just in the same way that there are very few atheists in foxholes, I think that there are very few people who advocate complete consumer control who are in a hospital. The most important thing to keep in mind is that we don't believe that this system of individual responsibility has worked particularly well in retirement, and we should at least take a look at why it hasn't worked well in retirement before we decide to head down that road in healthcare.
So do you foresee a great risk shift will happen in healthcare or not?
I think a great risk shift has already happened. I mean, look at the decline in the share of Americans who have health insurance at all. Look at the amount of costs that have been shifted onto individuals over the last decade. I mean, the fact is that because our healthcare costs are so much higher and rising so much faster than they are in other nations, Americans have been bearing more and more of the cost, even as insurance has picked up a big share of the increase. So somehow somebody's got to pay, and if healthcare costs keep rising at double-digit rates, it's consumers, Americans, who will pay.
Jacob Hacker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This being a show about healthcare, you gotta see the doctor, right? So I did, earlier this week here in Philly. I was battling a nasty cold at the time, but it's not why we were there. No, we wanted a behind-the-scenes look at one of the greatest of all medical mysteries. Why, oh why, do we spend so much time in doctors' waiting rooms? We arrived at the offices of Greenhouse Internists in Philadelphia's Mount Airy neighborhood just before 11 a.m. The waiting area was full, and Omega London was answering phones at the front desk.
Good morning, Greenhouse Internists. This is Omega. How can I help you?
London's been working here for 14 years. The patient on the phone needs stitches removed, which will require an office visit.
That's absolutely right. How long have you had them in? Okay. Who's your doctor here? All right, do you want to do 12? You could be his first appointment for the afternoon. That's good? Okay.
We patients have tried it all, right? First appointment of the day, first appointment after lunch, first appointment with Mercury in retrograde. London has seen her share of annoyed patients. But medicine, she says, is not an exact science, at least not when it comes to scheduling.
I would love to tell everyone, come on in at 9. I'm going to have you out by 9:30. You can catch that train, get to work, won't be late, and tell everyone you were at the doctor's office. You know, it doesn't work like this.
Can I presume it's by design that there's not a single clock to be found in this place?
We don't have one out there, and I can't actually say why. I can't say that we deliberately not put a clock out there, but all the years of being here, we haven't had a clock. And you're not the first person that told us that.
We, like doctors everywhere, try to run on time, and like doctors everywhere, tend not quite to make that happen.
Dr. Richard Barron is one of 7 internists in the Greenhouse practice.
Complicated set of issues. The patient may have told somebody at the front desk, oh, I'm here for a cold, but actually they have a list of 5 different things. You're going to run late for the next patient.
Plus, he says, doctors are doing all kinds of things that the patient doesn't necessarily see. In fact, he wrote about this very subject earlier this year in the New England Journal of Medicine. The article was titled, What's Keeping Us So Busy in Primary Care?
Each doctor in this office sees an average of a little over 18 patient visits per day, but each doctor makes 23.6 phone calls. Each doctor refills 12.4 prescriptions. Each doctor reviews something over 15 laboratory reports. It's not visible to patients, so that's one reason that people are frustrated when their doctor may not be with them face-to-face.
Not visible to patients and not visible to insurance companies. Most insurance pays per office visit, creating a perverse incentive for some doctors to overbook or otherwise pack patients into the day, creating delays. Greenhouse, however, is in the vanguard of finding solutions to the problem. The practice uses electronic medical records for pretty much everything. Medical assistants conduct a lot of the time-intensive counseling for patients with chronic illnesses. And Greenhouse utilizes something called open access scheduling. No patients are scheduled after 11 a.m., leaving the rest of the day for last-minute appointments.
If you run a schedule where you're making appointments for 6 weeks away, you find that often patients don't keep those appointments because whatever problem they had has gone away.
Generally, you're in and out of here in a reasonable time. When I say reasonable, maybe within a half hour, 45 minutes, which I think is pretty good.
Sam Feinberg has been coming to see Dr. Barron for the last 12 years. He's 85 and lives in Elkins Park, just outside Philly. He was in to have some routine checks done on his health.
Hi,
Hi, Mr. Farber. How are you
Doris,
today?
Doris, we've been through this practice a few times, right?
Yeah.
Feinberg says he thinks a big part of the problem is there aren't enough primary care doctors in the area. And studies bear that out nationwide.
Well, your blood pressure is great today. And I'm going to check your pulse.
I think we expect that anymore. We expect that we're going to go in and it's going to take some time. And we're prepared to give that time because there's nothing much else you can do if you've got to have work done. So my best advice is when you go to the doctor's office, bring a book to read.
Doris Pitts was the medical assistant taking Feinberg's blood pressure. She said that day one of the staff called in sick, which added to the exam room pressures. Her advice?
Patience. Have to be patient.
Debbie, extension 2, please. Debbie, extension 2.
The thing to remember, says Dr. Barron, is that medicine is not an assembly line, though his practice, for one, is always looking for efficiencies.
Each patient comes in differently, and each patient has different needs, and one of the core functions of primary care is to meet patients where they are.
Dare I ask how much delay is caused by reporters hanging around your office?
I knew you were coming, and I blocked out some time to talk to you so that I wouldn't keep you waiting and I wouldn't keep patients waiting talking to you.
Now, if we could only read their writing. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and we are broadcasting from Philadelphia this week with a special hour on healthcare. So now I have a message for all those listeners who are not sick. You still see a doctor, right, for a yearly checkup? The general medical exam is by far the most common reason that people go see a doctor. Even our healthcare reporter Gregory Warner got one, right, Gregory?
I did. I went to Dr. Steve Peitzman. He's a doctor at Drexel University. Heitzman is also a medical historian, but we're going to get to that in a minute.
About 120 over 84.
Anyway, as he's examining me, he admits something that I don't think I had realized before.
All right. Open your mouth, say the traditional ritual ah.
Ah.
Okay, now that's all pretty worthless because I wouldn't expect to find anything.
But no, wait, you said it was worthless? The whole throat thing is worthless?
Well, you have no sore throat. I'm not going to find anything that's preventive in looking at your throat or your
eyes. You just kind of do it anyway?
Well, I sort of do it anyway.
Even the parts of the exam that don't make clinical sense for every patient.
So the parts that don't make too much sense are, in fact, what many, many people associate with being examined. The stethoscope on the chest, listening to the heart or lungs.
And if Peitzman does that stuff even when it's not medically necessary, it's because he knows that the physical is half checkup, half comfort ritual.
Right.
The annual physical, though, did not start that way. It started in the 1870s by doctors working for life insurance companies, and it was not about treatment.
They wanted to screen potential customers with the idea of not writing a policy on somebody who had a heart murmur, who had an enlarged liver, who had a wheezing or crackling sounds in the lung that could be tuberculosis.
Pre-existing conditions, in other words. And then came a Philadelphia doctor named George Gould, and he changed all that.
Gould really did have this idealistic notion that a careful examination might detect disease in a pre-symptomatic state, as he referred to it, the symptom of the symptom. And wouldn't it be possible to abort the illness if you could detect it very early? Doesn't give too many examples, but he tosses out that concept very strongly.
And on June 7th, in the year 1900, the American Medical Association, the AMA, gathers in Atlantic City for its annual conference, and George Gould gives a speech.
Urging that physicians broadly pick up the concept of the periodic full examination. So here's what he said in this address. He said, "It is the shame of medicine and the basis of quackery, the symptom treating and symptom killing."
That summer day, Gould offered the AMA a new definition of the doctor. He's the person who tells you if you have a problem before you know if you have a problem.
In my mind, the general practitioners in that audience would be raising the question, what is this guy talking about? Who wants to pay a fee to come in and see me when they're feeling fine, and I want to take 20 minutes to poke and prod them and gather a little bit of urine? Who's going to pay me for that?
In the year 1900, when Gould gave his speech, that was a good question. But pretty soon, lots of people were willing to pay. And by 1923, the U.S. Public Health Association could launch a nationwide campaign with the slogan, "Have a health examination on your birthday." Their goal? To perform 10 million examinations in the first year. Everybody, say ah.
For all the national discussions about healthcare and reform, one thing is clear, and that is that nothing is clear. We surveyed some folks at Philadelphia's Reading Market this week about the confusing morass that is the American healthcare system.
Probably in this day and age, just knowing which doctor is in which network.
Paying for it, really.
How to compare the different providers, what's covered, what's not.
Paperwork. I don't know. All the papers involved.
The options. There's so many of them.
Dealing with issues like pre-existing conditions.
Understanding your benefits. I worked for an insurance company. Most of the time when we would receive calls, it was to explain benefits and to explain why benefits were denied.
Makes you wish you had someone to hold your hand through the entire process, doesn't it? Well, that's why the job of healthcare advocate was invented. Here's a look at one.
My name is Betty Long, and I'm president and founder of Guardian Nurses Healthcare Advocates. The analogy that I always use is that you wouldn't enter the legal system without an attorney. And I think that it's likely that you shouldn't enter the healthcare system without an advocate. Who better to advocate for someone than a nurse? I think the healthcare system is complex. Patients who are confused don't really know which way to go. And I think it's helpful to have someone by your side who understands the system, who understands what needs to happen, what needs to be asked, and we can take that stress from them. It's not that we tell patients what to do, it's we guide them and give them the options so that they can make a better decision. Is it better or worse for your loved one to endure this chemo, this experimental treatment, or is it better to have a quality of life that allows him to interact with his family? Guardian Nurses was really started in 2003. My uncle had fallen and had a cerebral bleed. He was taken to a critical care unit, and my aunt called me, and I went down, and there was a moment when the resident was talking to my aunt and telling her that we're going to put a breathing tube in your husband's throat. And I saw my aunt nodding her head, and I looked at her, and I looked at the doctor, and I thought, she has no clue what he's talking about. What do other people do that don't have someone like a nurse or someone clinical to explain it after the doctor leaves? A lot of us who are young and healthy don't think about that. And maybe if we've had an experience where one of our loved ones or our parents have had that, then maybe it's more in our head and we'll consider it. But most people don't think about it.
Betty Long's interview was reported by Joel Rose.
Marketplace Money is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 127 hours based on the true story of Aaron Ralston from the director of Slumdog Millionaire Danny Boyle and starring James Franco, now playing in select theaters. By Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. And by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at chevyvolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We started this hour with Ben Franklin and the birth of mass healthcare information in America. Well, it's all grown up now. The internet, TV. We wondered how all that has altered the doctor-patient relationship. In a moment, we'll visit a group of medical residents facing that very question. But first, an imagined account of that relationship from cast members of the Pig Iron Theater Company here in Philadelphia.
Ah, Mr. Horcher.
Hi, Dr. Matthews.
Hi, how are you doing there? You feeling all right?
Yeah.
Excellent.
About that rash.
Yes. Glad that you came back in. We just have a few questions I need to go over.
Sure. I happened to look up my own medical records on your website.
That's what it's there for.
That's great.
Okay.
Don't know if you saw that article in the Boston Globe about rashes, but I compared my image to one I saw on WebMD.
Okay, good. Just take a deep breath.
Anyway, I just happened to tune in to Grey's Anatomy. I don't know if you watch that show. My girlfriend watches it. I happened to tune in because
Sandra Oh.
They're doing a show about mm-hmm. rashes, and some guy comes
and just
in,
tilt your head over to one side and look in your
some
ear.
Some kind of normal rash ends as a flesh-eating bacteria.
And ooh, that sounds terrible. And
so
look
I took
up
my info and plugged it into iDiagnose.
What iDiagnose was that?
Well, it's a iPhone app that I have. I have a light.
I just have a BlackBerry. Okay, yeah. Open up and say ah.
Anyway, there's at least a potential that I have epidermal necrosis. Fortunately, there's a clinical trial for people with my condition, and I went ahead and talked to my insurance company. They say I'm eligible for total reimbursement of this program. I just need a signature from a doctor, and you're a doctor, so I
I'm not going to sign you up for an experimental, unverified drug treatment when all you have is a rash, which you're frankly making worse by scratching.
I'm just trying to empower myself with information as a patient and take control of my own health and my own body.
Good. The informed patient is a valuable member of the treatment team.
I just need you to sign this paper. I brought a pen. It needs to be signed in blue.
Sure.
Thanks, doctor. I'll be sure to let you know how it's going. I will update my medical records, and I'll let you know.
Great. I'm going to go weigh myself.
Thanks to actors Quinn Borodell and Jeff Sobel. There's a puppet version of that skit at marketplace.org. Yes, puppets. As the Pig Iron Funny Man made clear, good communication skills are essential when dealing with patients. That's why Dr. Dennis Novak teaches seminars about it to first-year residents at the Drexel University College of Medicine here in Philly. He says doctors are being trained differently to care for the informed patient who is armed with questions and internet research. Well, so armed with a copy of that skit, we dropped by one of his classes earlier this week to see how those doctors-to-be are preparing.
Okay, so this is one of our classes in our doctoring curriculum. And actually, we were speaking about patient education and counseling. And, you know, certainly we want our patients to be partners in their own healthcare, and we want to empower our patients. And it's not all that unusual that patients will come in and know something about their illnesses or even have looked them up. It's just a question of what we do with that and how we respond to it. So what do you guys do, you know, when patients ask you for things that you think are not quite indicated?
In other words, the patient thinks that he or she is informed.
Yeah.
And perhaps is not.
Yeah.
This is Dr. John. I think that this skit was actually an excellent depiction of how we've really fallen from true bedside manner, where the doctor is kind of glorified as this well-knowing, you know, guru, let's say, of medicine, to the patient being a consumer. And I think that that's really where the distrust really comes into play. I think the problem is when you have a consumer who's coming to your office, and I'm putting fake quotation marks around that, the issue is they're really looking for what they want. They want a bargain, if you will, not necessarily in terms of price, but rather in terms of what they can, I don't want to say weasel out of you because that puts me in a bad light, but I mean, if I could be so dramatic, I would put it that way, in terms of what they want from their healthcare. And I think that's really where the distrust comes into play. I mean, blame that on our economy, blame that on, you know, the way advertisement is this way, blame it on insurance companies. But I think the only way to really fix that is by creating a genuine relationship from the very beginning that promotes a team-like mentality between you and the patient, where you both are on the same page and you both have the same treatment goals in mind.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about kind of that shift in the relationship, because we are now consumers, not patients, and you are a service provider, not a doctor.
Exactly.
Dr. Novak, when did that change?
It's been changing, and I think the HMOs have probably had a lot to do with it, and the demands on our time. And, you know, it used to be that we would make the decisions, and now we have all sorts of people looking over our shoulders telling us what decisions we should make, how many patients we should see. So we have a lot of pressures on us. And the internet has provided people with free information. So it's true, we have a lot of patients looking up things and thinking they know things. And I think because doctors have had less time you know, to explain things to patients and to create relationships. Patients have sort of filled in that gap and are trying to get the most out of the time they have with doctors. So,
hi, this is Dr. Deshpande. As well as being someone, you know, who treats disease, you know, makes people feel better, you know, we're also educators. Obviously, the job is made infinitely harder when, you know, everyone has access to the internet, more or less. So, you know, there is going to be a lot of misinformation out there, and it's our jobs to sort of sort through that misinformation and give them the right information as best we can.
So that's what we're trying to promote, patients who are true partners in their healthcare. They'll just do better. One of the goals of this course is to talk about some of the psychosocial interventions or some of the ways of approaching people's emotions, fears, concerns, beliefs, and so on. So I want to ask, you know, a patient comes in and says, this rash, I'm really concerned. It's a fatal disease. What do you say to them?
Well, Dr. John, I think what we would do in that situation is really go from a broader perspective and ask the patient what's going on in their life in terms of stressors, et cetera, you know, what their home environment is like. Because for a patient to present with such a strong concern of a quote-unquote fatal rash is a clear depiction in my mind, or red flag, if you will, that there are obviously other stressors that are coming into
play.
Okay,
but a little role play here. Mm-hmm. Doctor, I have this rash, and I'm really, really worried about it. I think it's a fatal disease.
What is it about the rash, rather, that is so concerning for you?
Well, I mean, I looked it up on the internet, and it's this epidermal necrolysis or something. It's the same thing. I mean, it really, really looks that way.
Hmm.
So it seems to be spreading, and I'm scratching it all the time. And
I see. Okay. And when did you first start noticing this rash?
Well, just a couple days ago.
Just a couple days ago?
Yeah.
Okay. How's everything else been going? Anything else changed a couple days ago? How have things been going at home and at work?
I don't know what that has to do with my rash. But
well, I just want to get a sense of what's going on. Touché. Well, yes. I mean, of course I could be going with exposures, but
I'm thinking an empathic comment at this moment might be good. Legitimize their concerns.
So what can your informed patient take away from this? What words of advice would you have for them as they interact with you?
John Gain, I think that a lot of times physicians are human, and it's easy to get feeling as if patients coming in with information is somehow supplanting your role. You know, you can react to that in a couple different ways. You can be angry. You can get upset with the patient. You can acknowledge their efforts, and to work with them, be a partner with them.
Alex Lockerman.
So I think the informed patient is actually, it's a great opportunity for the physicians to stay on top of their game. You know, when someone's coming in prepared, that you're not just going to get by with saying, you know, do X, Y, Z, and the patient's going to, you know, go ahead and do it. So it's give and take.
Dr. John, I actually say welcome to the informed patient. And if I could be even more cheesy, I would say, you know, help me help you. I think that this is definitely the future of medicine. And I think that this is the kind of mindset that, generally speaking, we all need to adopt.
Yeah. Wouldn't we all feel great if our patients were true partners with us?
So you can be both doctor, patient, and service provider and consumer.
Yes.
Thank you all for letting us sit in on this.
Thank you for being here.
You heard from Drs. Amit Deshpande, Cindy John, Alex Schlachterman, John Gain, and, of course, Dr. Dennis Novak, who we found out has a pretty interesting side gig fronting the Dr. Novak experience.
Well, first of all, I love being in a band. It's healing for me. And in an odd way, it's a commitment to my patients. If I'm not in balance, I'm not going to be there for my patients. I've been in a band now for 24 years. My bandmates are mostly medical students. So every year there's a few people who graduate, and we have to find some new folks. I think I've had close to 100 people in my bands over the years. Oh, if you start me up. Keeps me young. You know, think about Mick Jagger. He must exercise like 6-8 hours a day to do what he does. You know, you have to be in shape.
Do you know how old Mick Jagger is?
He's a few years older than I am.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Special thanks to our friends here at WHYY in Philadelphia for their support and assistance this week.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Robeson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you back in L.A. next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments. Recent tax law changes could mean new opportunities to save for retirement. You can talk to your financial advisor and get the latest news and insights at RothIRAblog.com. American Public Media.